I'm Janice Dean, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, April 20th, 2018. I'm Dave Anthony. The FAA is on a new mission to prevent fright on another flight.
There was a very loud noise, and the plane started vibrating and shuddering.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. For the first time in almost 60 years, a Castro will not be ruling Cuba.
It appears to be a major transition.
And I'm Van Hipp. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
It happened without warning on Southwest Flight 1380 Tuesday morning, about 20 minutes after takeoff from New York's LaGuardia Airport headed to Dallas.
We heard a big bang, like some sort of explosive sound.
That was an engine on the left side blowing up. It shattered one of the plane's windows and sucked one of the passengers partially out of the plane.
We couldn't pull her in. The guy helped, and we got her pulled in, and they tried to resuscitate her.
They said, does anyone know CPR? I took off my mask, I took off my seatbelt, and I went.
Peggy Phillips is a nurse and saw right away the situation was dire.
Her injuries were substantial. There was a lot of trauma. To her head and her neck and her upper torso.
And Phillips told Fox and Friends she tried CPR.
I didn't feel like I ever got an airway established very well. There was no pulse.
About 20 minutes later, the plane made an emergency landing in Philadelphia, and Jennifer Reardon was pronounced dead. A 43-year-old bank executive from New Mexico whose last tweet the night before was a picture of Midtown Manhattan from her hotel, writing, "She had a great business day."
She had two kids. And a loving husband, and a community around her.
Andrew Needham is a firefighter and a paramedic who was also on board the plane and helped to try to revive her.
So my heart is broken for them.
Passengers also praised the pilot, Tammy Jo Schultz, as a hero.
She was amazing. I mean, 30 years experience and just knew to get us down, and she's phenomenal.
Now the focus is on the engine and how to prevent more failures.
It's extremely rare.
Rob Mark is senior editor of Flying Magazine, a commercial pilot who is also an air traffic controller and a supervisor with the FAA.
I mean, the engines that are on that 737 are very, very common engines. They have a great safety record. There are hundreds of thousands of safe flying hours on them. And, of course, Southwest Airlines is the biggest operator of the 737.
Yeah, that's all they use, correct?
That's right. They only fly 737s. It was a business strategy back in the days when Herb Kelleher was there because it made life easy. Training was easy for the mechanics, the pilots, the ramp people, everything.
Investigators already know what went wrong.
One of the fan blades, the number 13 fan blade, was separated and missing.
NTSB Chairman Robert Sumwalt. Now, the same thing happened on a Southwest Airlines flight in 2016. The shrapnel gashed that plane, but didn't cause a hole like Tuesday. And now the FAA is readying an order for airlines to inspect engines on similar jets after a certain number of takeoffs and landings. Now, the manufacturer recommended that nearly a year ago, and that prompted European regulators to order more inspections, and a lawyer suing American Airlines over another engine explosion says the FAA should also have acted sooner.
I really believe in my heart, having spent my life in this industry, that they thought they had the problem under control after the event a couple of years ago. And what we found out the other day was that it's a rare occurrence, but sometimes machines break no matter what you try.
Metal fatigue is something that they're going to look for in these ultrasonic inspections. So what are we talking about exactly?
What we're talking about here, when it's metal fatigue, are cracks, very, very fine cracks, too small for the eye to even notice. The only way they would be noticeable would be with special maintenance investigative techniques. And that's almost like an X-ray on metal that would show these up. And I think they thought that these engines would be able to fly longer without these kinds of inspections. But apparently what they're finding is that they were wrong on that, and they're going to have to do them more often.
So inside the engine this happens, how does what happens inside then get outside and shatter a window?
there is a ring around the outside of the engine that is a containment device that is supposed to prevent these, you know, random parts from flying out and damaging the aircraft. It didn't help the last time back in 2016, and it didn't help this time. It was not able to prevent it, and one of those pieces just hit the window, and it was enough to crack it, and a few seconds later, it just blew out.
Now, Jennifer Reardon was the first person killed on a commercial flight in the U.S. since 2009, but you have to go much further back for instances of a hole blown up on a plane killing someone. In 1973, an engine also blew out on a National Airlines flight, and a passenger was completely sucked out into an engine. In 1988, a hole ripped open on the top of an Aloha Airlines plane, and the force of that sent a flight attendant out into the sky. And in 1989, a cargo door ripped off a United flight, smashing open the 747. Nine passengers in their seats were ejected, and their remains were never found at sea.
At that point, the pressure inside the cabin is very high. That's how we maintain breathable air inside the fuselage. They just pump it full of air, and it makes people feel like they're down on the ground. But it's a very high pressure, and when you're up at 30 or 40,000 feet, the air outside is a very low pressure. So it's almost like water seeking its own level. As soon as that window breaks, that high pressure wants to escape from the fuselage to balance out the air. And as it goes, you know, flying out of the cabin, it takes anything with it that's not tied down.
It's hard to fathom what that's like to try to pull back against.
It's impossible to pull back against. I mean, I know people say, well, I'll just hold on. And I'm really annoying, I think, when I fly on the airlines, because I see people holding infants and they say, oh, don't worry, I will grab them if anything happens. And what they don't realize is that the chances of them being able to hold an infant, to hold anything, to hold a book, to hold a briefcase, to hold their coat, is absolutely impossible, let alone, and let's face it, they're trying to breathe at the same time, which, as you probably saw in some of those photos, people did not watch what the flight attendant had demonstrated prior to takeoff, because they didn't have the little orange cones over their noses. They just had them over their mouths, and that makes the oxygen much less effective.
The pilot had to get that plane to the ground. How difficult was that to do?
The first thing the pilot does is pull the throttles back and essentially try to dive the airplane. I know it scares the bejesus out of the folks in the back, but the goal is to get the airplane down from 30 or 35,000 feet down to something in the 12 to 14,000 foot altitude where people can breathe without oxygen.
They were at 35,000 feet. They went down to like 13,000 feet in about 5 minutes.
We train for these kinds of situations all the time. So that's why I think, beside the fact that the captain was a good pilot, you hear her voice, and she sounded incredibly calm.
Press fire, but part of it's missing. They said there was a hole and someone went out.
I'm sorry, you said there was a hole and somebody went out?
Because it's just like you do it in training. And you go, okay, we do this, we do that, and we get it down. And our goal is to make sure that everybody's safe on board.
People are freaked out, though. Anytime there's an issue like this on an airplane, I mean, because everyone's like, oh, I can't even imagine. I've been flying. Well, I can't imagine what would happen if that happened to my plane. A lot of people have a fear of flying because they're not in control. They're just sitting there. There's nothing they can do, even though it's actually a lot more dangerous to drive.
I think when you talk about these statistics, when you're in an event like that, nobody's thinking about statistics. All they're thinking about is, oh my heavens, we're going to die.
People shouldn't be more concerned, in your view?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't be. I mean, of course, I'm probably incredibly biased when I say that, but I do take certain steps. I mean, when I get on an airliner, and my wife and my daughter have all come to understand this, and they do it themselves, we get into a seat somewhere and we figure out where the emergency exit is. And they always tell you it might be behind you. Is it three rows behind you? Is it four rows in front of you? Because in a panic, you may only be able to count the rows to tell you where the emergency exit is. And same thing with the oxygen masks. I taught my daughter this when she was very young. You put it over your entire mouth and your nose, or you won't be able to breathe. And it makes sense, but no one ever pays attention to the flight attendants because it's way too... It's like getting on a bus these days. It'll never happen to me.
Rob, Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
You're most welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
This is Van Hip with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Cuba has a new president, and for the first time in nearly 60 years, it is not a Castro. Cuba's National Assembly approved the nomination of 57-year-old Miguel Díaz-Canel to the presidency.
The electoral revolutionary process culminates, which in the last few months...
He was born 1 year after Fidel Castro's revolution and said in his speech before the National Assembly that the people voted for us to continue the revolution. Former President Raúl Castro, Fidel's brother, will remain head of the Communist Party. To be clear, the people did not vote for Díaz-Canel directly. He'd been called the heir apparent to the Castro regime. He was picked by Raúl, who took over a decade ago, about 8 years before Fidel Castro died in 2016. Raúl is now 86 years old. And Díaz-Canel, a longtime communist bureaucrat, was elected by the National Assembly, a group of elected representatives, nearly unanimously. Díaz-Canel has promised to essentially continue what the Castros started.
Continuity is the word you hear over and over again. In other words, nothing is going to change.
Fox News correspondent Steve Harrigan spoke to us from Havana.
That's going to be a real challenge when you have an economy that's cratering, when you have three or four people still working for the state, most of them making less than $35 a month. How patient are the 11 million people on this island going to be with someone who was not in the revolution, who's not named Castro, and who hasn't exhibited just the incredible tenacity, no matter what you think of his politics, but the Castros were survivors, and they survived against huge odds for six decades. Will the same be said of this relatively unknown lifetime communist bureaucrat who'll take office?
Steve, you've been to Cuba several times, right?
I have.
How's it changed over the years, and especially in the last few, since President Obama tried to, I guess, normalize or warm things up, if you will?
I think there was a lot of excitement in 2014, 15, 16 at the start of the thaw. The opening of the embassy brought a lot of excitement, and I think there was a sense among many Cubans that there would be tremendous change and economic opportunities. Relations have really soured in the past several months here, especially with that mysterious sonic attack against U.S. diplomats that injured about two dozen Americans.
Last year, several U.S. embassy workers complained of headaches and hearing loss after hearing strange shrill noises inside of homes and two hotels. Many were recalled back to the United States. Cuba denies they attacked U.S. personnel, and some scientists say it may have been old spy technology that malfunctioned, but the cause is still unknown.
U.S. tourism is down, and I don't think there's a sense that with this new leadership and new name that they are, you know, heading to a bright new future. I think there's a basic shortage of food supplies and not a lot of hope for the economy to get going. So I think it's a pretty grim atmosphere. That aside, though, as a Westerner coming in here, some things happen that didn't happen before. Your phone works immediately. Email, calls, all that stuff works. So at least for the internet, at least for foreigners, at least for people who can afford it, it's gotten a little bit more comfortable.
What are younger Cubans, really, what are all Cubans sort of telling you about what they want? And do you get the sense that they're honest with you and that they feel they can be honest with you about what they want?
I think honesty can be very guarded, especially if you have, you know, a large television camera in front of people. It's a society where people have been encouraged to tell on each other and to report on each other and rewarded for doing so. But I think one of the challenges that any leadership is going to have here is that it's such a young society and such a future-oriented society. The old guard is still in charge, but as a people, it's a very young group of people who are looking for more internet access and who are looking to travel more, and it's going to be tough to tell them to be patient. I wonder here how patient the Cubans are going to be with the conditions that they live under when the world is getting more and more transparent, more and more visible. People can see how other people are living a lot easier than they have in the past.
this Miguel Diaz-Canel individual, what can you tell us about him? How did he get to where he got?
He was a regional communist leader, known for some sort of openness, allowing a gay nightclub in his area to thrive, riding a bicycle instead of using an official car during times of shortages. He's really beefed up his conservative credibility, perhaps with a deliberate leaking of a tape where he criticized these small independent businesses that have opened up in the past few years as being the enemy of the Cuban Revolution. That might be to garner some more hardline support. But he's been picked by Raul Castro, and he has kept his nose down and avoided the limelight and avoided the missteps. He seems to me as someone who's going to try and keep things on course and not rock the boat, which might please the leadership, but I doubt it's going to please a lot of Cubans on the street.
Francisco Jose Hernandez, who goes by Pepe, took part in the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1960 as a 20-something Cuban. The U.S.-backed effort to train a bunch of Cuban exiles who would fight Fidel Castro's new government failed almost immediately. And the last time he was in Cuba was in 1962, when he was released from prison for participating in the Bay of Pigs. He won't confirm on the record that he worked for the CIA for many years, but he became a U.S. Marine captain and served during Vietnam. He eventually went on to help start the Cuban American National Foundation, a major lobbying group in Florida. He says for everything his group has tried to do, the old guard is out, and it's young Cubans who will now have to fight for the future they want.
We are not going to be able to do it. They are the only ones who can change the situation in Cuba.
And he says that's more difficult now, as so many have fled over the years.
In the next 3 to 5 years, the Cuban government is going to have to realize that they cannot continue in the same situation that they have maintained, the Cuban people, over these years.
He says he has mixed feelings, thrilled that a Castro isn't president anymore, but knows Raul is still heading the Communist Party, and Diaz-Canel has insisted on a policy of continuity with what came before him. Dr. Brian Littell isn't so sure Cuba's going to change so quickly, let alone in 3 to 5 years. As for Cuba-U.S. relations, the author and Florida International University professor compares the shift from President Obama's attempt at normalizing relations with Cuba to President Trump's tougher stance.
Well, it's hard to be optimistic, especially now that Trump has brought in John Bolton to be his national security advisor, and Pompeo, CIA director currently, to be Secretary of State, both very, very well-known, articulate hardliners. And Marco Rubio has a lot of influence on Cuba policy in this administration. And I think certainly Bolton and Rubio, those two at least, and maybe all three, will probably be advocating a much tougher, more restrictive policy on Cuba. But look, there are a lot of things that did not change from what Obama achieved. We still have embassies in both countries.
Right.
The immigration policies have not really changed. The wet foot, dry foot policy that Obama ended, it's not going to be renewed. Trump is not going to renew it. The cruise ships, the airliners that are ferrying increasing numbers of Americans down to Cuba to spend money in the tourism industry, that's continuing. And Trump has not added Cuba back to the list of state sponsors of terrorism. He hasn't done that. So it's not quite as bad as some people might think. Trump hasn't done all of the things that he could have done to reverse Obama's opening.
Where is Cuba heading? Is Cuba going to be communist forever? Or in your lifetime, in my lifetime, will we see a Cuba that is either a democratic republic or something close to it?
I'm not optimistic that Cuba is going to break out into democracy in the foreseeable future. I think it's much more likely that this new regime with Diaz-Canel at the head of it, if he serves 10 years as president, which is pretty much the way they're setting it up now, to 2 5-year terms and term limits. So if he serves 10 years, I think the odds are slightly better than even, that at the end of 10 years, Cuba will still be a communist dictatorship with more of an entrepreneurial economy, something resembling maybe China and Vietnam, but with still very strict controls. And there may also be an oligarchic class of Cubans, especially amongst military officers who are also businessmen. The chances of Cuba becoming democratic in the next 10 years, I don't think, are good at all.
Professor, thank you so much for your time.
Download Perito and Steierwald. I'll tell you what.
Is it a lot of pressure to cook you dinner?
No, because I eat it. I ate hot dogs for breakfast on a moving train and loved it.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcast.com.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
When we lose a national figure, we can't help but stop and think about their life. Obituaries are written, tributes are penned, and we are reminded of details about that person we may have forgotten along the winding road of history. Former First Lady Barbara Bush, who died this week at age 92, is one of those people. She and former President George H.W. Bush were married 73 years and had 6 children. One of those, of course, was former President George W. Bush, and another was former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. The Bushes lost a child in 1953, a little girl named Robin, who died of leukemia when she was just 3 years old. Marshall Ramsey is an editorial cartoonist whose work for the Jackson, Mississippi Clarion Ledger has earned him the honor of being a Pulitzer Prize finalist twice. He's also the artist behind an obituary cartoon remembering Mrs. Bush. It's just a single frame, and it shows Mrs. Bush just inside the golden gates of heaven, complete with her unmistakable pearls, a white robe and white wings, arms wide open in a welcoming gesture. She excitedly yells, "Robin!" Running toward her in the picture is a little blonde girl, arms also out with a little halo and puffs of dust coming up off the ground where her feet are quickly moving. The girl says just one word, "Mama." It's gone viral and has even been shared by Mrs. Bush's granddaughter, Jenna Bush Hager, on Instagram. I talked to Marshall Ramsey and asked him how he came up with the idea for the cartoon.
Cartoonists do obituary cartoons, and a lot of times they can be cliched. You can just have somebody marching into heaven, you know, so forth. And I want to kind of take a different tack on this. And I took off my cartoonist hat and put on my parent hat. And I thought about the life that she had lived. And, I mean, an amazing life, just all the things that the Bush family's done. And I thought about that one moment that probably absolutely ripped her heart out was when they lost Robin. And I thought, well, you know what? She's healed, and she's back with Robin again. And so, I mean, I sketched it out, and then I sketched a couple other cartoons just to pitch to my editor. And he looked at them, and, you know, of course, I always put the one I want on top. You know, that's just my subliminal way of trying to, you know, get my editor to make sure that he picks the right cartoon. And he just looked at it and he said, "Oh, yeah, that's the cartoon. You need to do that." So I drew it. I put it up online, and within an hour, Jenna Bush Hager gotten a hold of it and it on her Instagram, and then it was off to the races.
And it's that small word of "mama" that packs an emotional punch for the reader.
It is actually not on the original because with it being reversed, with it being white letters on black, I just went ahead and did it on the computer. But I wanted to convey a way to show that Robin knew that that was her mom, because obviously Barbara Bush didn't look like Barbara Bush that we knew her back in when Robin was alive. But I just wanted to know that instant, you know, acknowledgement that she knew that that was her mom. And I didn't, you know, obviously the words are small, but it was just, I knew that was going to be the detail that made the difference on it.
He's drawn more than 6,000 cartoons while he's been with the Clarion Ledger and says the feedback from this one has been overwhelming.
You do a lot of snarky cartoons. You do a lot of cutting cartoons. You do a lot of funny cartoons. And you make a lot of people mad, and sometimes you're like, yeah, good, I'm glad they're mad. But when you do an obituary cartoon and you find out that the family likes it and they ask for the original, you know, you just kind of feel like, well, good, if I gave them one moment to smile in the middle, because I mean, I just lost my parents, and I mean, I know what that's like, and if somebody can make you smile, then that's a very powerful moment.
He's heard from a lot of people for whom this cartoon stirred up emotions.
That means the world to me, that the family really meant enough that they would do that. But then I start hearing from parents who'd lost children. And those messages were, I'm not a crier. I think I cried at the end of Old Yeller, you know. I mean, but to see these really heartfelt messages from people saying, "I'm going to see my child again someday. I was just sitting here reading some of them to my wife last night, and we're just looking at each other going, wow. And then we hugged our children really tight.
In an interview with the Today Show in 2012, Barbara Bush talked about Robin, recalling being with her when she died. She detailed combing her hair and holding the little girl's hand and seeing her spirit go. Mrs. Bush said Robin remained like an angel to her, a positive presence in her life. And that may be one reason Ramsey's cartoon speaks to so many of us. It gives you hope.
It's tough, and I can tell you from losing loved ones that, you know, you just miss them. And I know that she must have gone through her whole life missing her daughter. And just to hope that they're together again is so powerful.
Barbara Bush's final resting place is on the grounds of the George H.W. Bush Presidential Library at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas. It's where Pauline Robinson Robin Bush is buried and has been waiting for her. Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
Download Lauren Green's Lighthouse Faith.
We sort of think that God has nothing to say about our pain and suffering. God has nothing to say about our sex life. And the truth is that God is very much has spoken to all of these things.
Subscribe now at foxnewspodcast.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Van Hip.
What's on your mind?
President Trump has sent a message that his red line will not be crossed. It was important to degrade Syria's chemical weapons capability, and that's what we did. In addition, President Trump's actions were not lost on Kim Jong-un, and I believe this also weighed into the president's calculus. The North Korea nuclear threat is the greatest threat facing the United States today. American strength and leadership has brought Kim Jong-un to the table to discuss denuclearization. Kim Jong-un was watching how we would respond to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's latest chemical attack on his own people. Another complicating factor was Iran. Iran has been a great enabler of the North Korean nuclear threat, but they are also in Syria. It is important that the United States execute a three-pronged strategy simultaneously designed to drive a wedge between Russia, Assad, and Iran. Let's keep them busy and off balance, focusing on their own problems so they have less time for mischief and we can focus on our greatest national security challenge, North Korea. Here's a framework of how it could look. Assad, support an international campaign to go after him as a war criminal. Swedish and German prosecutors have been in the forefront of prosecuting Syria war crimes. Russia, here, let's focus on the 2013 UN Security Council agreement to destroy Syria's chemical weapons program. Why has Russia been AWOL for the past 5 years? And what happened to the inspections and required monthly reports? And why did Russia veto the continuation of the Joint Investigative Mechanism, which was investigating chemical weapons use in Syria? Iran, tension has been growing with a number of Arab states who have had it with Iran. In the fall of 2016, some 11 Arab nations complained to the United Nations that Iran was a state sponsor of terrorism. This was followed up in late 2017 with several Arab nations saying they would bring specifics to the UN Security Council. Anyone who looks at the history of Syria realizes that the phrase constant turmoil best describes it. And the U.S. needs to take steps now so that our involvement there doesn't escalate and the situation doesn't get out of control. President Trump's action in degrading Syria's chemical weapons capability was the right one. And it showed both Assad and Kim Jong-un that with him, red lines won't be crossed. I'm Van Hip.
You have been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to Fox News Radio's hourly newscast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, visit foxnews.com.